Well, brethren, obviously this is a unique experience for us. None of us was counting on having a at-home feast again this year, and certainly that can be. It's shifting ground. It's a finish line that's moved again for us, isn't it? Where we expected one thing, and it's changed again on us. You know, that can have an effect on us. And it's a part of this journey that we're on that no matter what, as Christians, we're going to have shifting ground. We're going to have things in front of us that we expect to go one way that go another way. We're going to have goals that we expected to obtain on this timeline, and it doesn't happen until this timeline. We're going to be affected by things that are beyond our control. This is just another example of that. This past summer, I think you'll understand the message today, and I think this is going to be one that's probably appropriate for us, given the circumstances and given the disappointment that we're all feeling at this point over the news that we won't be able to have any more in-more services together at this feast. So let me transition then into this message, and let me begin by describing for you or introducing to you this concept that I want to go through today via the Olympics that happened this past summer. Now, I don't know about you, but I've had a pretty strong interest in the Olympic Games over the years, in particular the gymnastics. I love to watch the young ladies in particular doing gymnastics. What they can do is so phenomenal. And it's just an amazing thing for me to watch. I've always loved it. I've always been enthralled by that. And I wonder, this year it wasn't so much. Why? Something's off. This whole COVID world we live in, something just feels off all the time. And so I wasn't enthused to tune in to the Olympics like I have historically. And, of course, the numbers were down. But still, the Olympics represents the most anticipated event every 4 years, the Summer Games every 4 years, in the alternate years, the Winter Games every 4 years. This past year, because of COVID, the 2020 Olympics were held in 2021 in Tokyo. What is it about the Games that captivates people? Because around the world, all of the nations represented, all of those people from those nations were tuning in to watch their team, if you will, their representatives of their government. What is it that captivates us about that? I think, well, perhaps the Olympic Games represents man's desire to achieve the pinnacle of human physical accomplishment. And certainly that does happen at the Olympics. We watch the very best performing at the very peak of their performance, doing things that are phenomenal. You know, world records are still being set. You would think that we've already gotten the very best of anyone's performance already on the books, right? But yet, world records continue to be set. There's always just that little bit more someone's able to do to move that bar just a little farther down the road. Perhaps it's the drama of the athletes. I know a lot of people tune in because of that. And so the coverage of that by those who, you know, for example, NBC was the ones who were covering it this year again. And they obviously try to tell a lot of stories about the athletes, because the drama is, you know, it's enticing. You want to know the stories, the backstories of these athletes that are doing these incredible things and achieving these incredible things. Maybe you want to see the pain that they've endured because they pushed themselves past all human conditioning, and you want to relate to them and you want to empathize with them. Maybe we want to see how they've overcome the scars that they wear, both the emotional, the physical, from all the attempts and yet all the failures. Because any athlete who's succeeded has failed many more times. Michael Jordan famously says all of the statistics of his failures when he's asked about his successes. He lists his failures because they are what led him to be successful. Any accomplished athlete thinks in those terms. Maybe it's just that we want to see that exaltation from all of the struggle that they've put in to achieve, and when they finally have done that, to see them win, to see them standing there, tears in many cases, because they've accomplished that thing they wanted so desperately to accomplish. I think there are a number of reasons why people are fascinated by and captivated by the Olympics. This is not anything new. You know, the Olympics were around 500 years before Paul wrote the letter to the church at Corinth. They were held every 4 years in Olympia. So the Olympic Games date back many, 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 many centuries. So they're not new. And of course, in Greek culture, it is the epitome of celebrating their gods to have competitions. And so there wasn't just the Olympic Games. They had the Pythian Games, the Nemean Games, the Isthmian Games as well. All of those rotating through four-year cycles. Paul was fully aware of this. And he brings us knowledge about his awareness, and he wants us to understand that there is a spiritual correlation that can be drawn from this. In 1 Corinthians chapter 9, beginning in verse 24, Paul writes, "Do you not know that those who run in a race all run, but one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may obtain it. And everyone who competes for the prize is temperate in all things. Now they do it to obtain a perishable crown, but we for an imperishable crown. Therefore I run thus, not with uncertainty. Thus I fight, not as one who beats the air, but I discipline my body and bring it into subjection, lest when I have preached to others, I myself should become disqualified." Paul uses this analogy to teach us some important lessons about our spiritual journey to make it into God's kingdom as what? First fruits. And so this is a wonderful opportunity for us to step back and take a look at this example. And yes, I think we're all going to find ways to apply that, not only spiritually, but in the current physical circumstances we find ourselves in dealing with COVID-19. The first lesson I want to draw from this is simple. There's a prize for those that compete. Again, 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 24 says, "Do you not know that those who run in a race run all, but one receives what? The prize." Why are they running? Are they running because it feels great? It's just for the endorphins? They're running for a prize. Paul doesn't focus on the competition. He focuses on the prize. That's the first thing I think we can draw from, the first lesson that we can draw from this is that Paul focused on the prize. Now, they, of course, were pursuing a wreath and some recognition. And he says here, that's a physical thing. We're not pursuing something perishable like a wreath. We're pursuing something imperishable. Our prize is very different. But the prize is what motivates the competitors. They crave victory to obtain the prize. Every competitor does. They don't crave third place. They don't crave second place. They crave that gold medal today. Matthew chapter 5 and verse 6, you're familiar with it, so I'll just read it to you, but if you want to make a note of it, Matthew chapter 5 and verse 6 says, "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be filled." Hunger and thirst for righteousness. Righteousness is a religious term. We hear that bantered around. And in church, for us, we would call that church speak. In the Christian community, the term righteousness gets bantered around regularly. What does it mean? Well, we could do entire sermons to flesh fully out, but at its root, the very basic meaning of righteousness is this: to be right with God. That's really what it means. And in this context, then, he's saying righteousness, that would then be an equivalence of the kingdom itself. And so you can't be in the kingdom unless you're right with God. Fundamentally, that's the end of that. You can't be in the kingdom unless you are right with God. And so do we crave the righteousness that would let us be in the kingdom? Do we crave that the way an athlete craves a gold medal? I think that's an interesting question. You know, I was at my wife and I took my grandson Micah out to lunch before the feast. And we're sitting at the table at this restaurant, and on the napkin holder is a sticker. And the sticker says, "We have what you crave." And there's pictures around it of some of the food items that this particular restaurant had. Why would they use the word crave? Well, it's what it implies. What does the word crave imply? Well, it evokes the imagery of one desperate to have something. One who has a powerful desire to obtain something. One who cannot live without the object of their desire. That's why they use words like that. They're trying to evoke in you that you are not happy right now because you don't have a chocolate shake. But we have what you crave. So come on up here and put your money down and we'll give you that and we'll satisfy that craving for you. Well, again, that's a perishable thing and we don't crave that the way they would like us to. Well, I suppose sometimes I crave a chocolate shake. I'll be honest about that. I don't know if crave is the right word, though. I mean, crave a chocolate shake? I mean, I like to have one. Maybe not crave it, though. All right, anyway, you get the point. There's a reason that this idea of craving something should be applied for us spiritually about the kingdom. We have to have that desire inside of us. Why? Because there's a finish line out there somewhere, and we've got to get to it. We need a motivation. You know what the motivation is? The same motivation it is for an Olympic athlete. The prize. The prize for us is to be a first fruit. And that has to be an all-consuming prize for us. It has to utterly drive our appetite to be in God's kingdom, to be a first fruit. That's our calling. As Paul said, 1 Corinthians 9:25, and everyone who competes for the prize, once again, he's not ambiguous here. He understands this is human nature. For everyone who competes for the prize is temperate in all things. Now they do it to obtain a perishable crown, but we for an imperishable crown. So Paul's trying to nail that nail down. He's trying to hit that nail with a hard hammer hit. Our prize is the kingdom. We've got to keep our eye on that prize. The second lesson I think we can draw from this is everyone who competes for that prize, who finishes their race, will win. Everyone who competes will win, who finishes. Verse 24 says, remember as he wraps this up, he says, but one receives the prize. You see, in this world, competition drives everything. There's only one gold medal. There's not 10 gold medals. There's only one first place. And everyone who competes for that is competing for first place. They're not competing for third place. They're competing for first place. And God here, Paul here, is trying to help us to understand God's competition isn't like that. Everyone wins. Who wins? Everyone does. There are no losers of those who choose to compete in this spiritual race and who finish. No losers. That's an incredible difference between Satan's way and God's way. Satan's way, only one winner. In God's way, everyone who competes and finishes wins. That's remarkable. You know, Olympic athletes give their all against every competitor in pursuit of that one single gold medal. And the brief limelight, you imagine? The brief limelight that it is to have human praise. And yet, what will they do to achieve that? The question for us is, what would we do to have something better than that? Something better than that temporary reward. Mark, chapter 13, verse 13. Mark chapter 13 and verse 13. I want to draw out this lesson a little bit further for us. It says, and you will be hated by all for my name's sake. But he who endures to the end shall be saved. We, in the English language, we like to put in those pronouns, no matter what. So we fill in a pronoun here. He who endures to the end. It's not really there in the Greek, because that's not the intent. The intent here isn't to draw out a quantity or to identify some volume of people. It is simply to say everyone who competes and finishes will win. Everyone. There is no restriction. There's no limited number of entrants that, sorry, the gate shut here, you're not in. You don't get to make it because we've already filled up somehow. That's not what that means. Better rendered, it would actually say, but who endures to the end shall be saved. That's a better rendering of that in terms of our understanding. It's who, meaning anyone, that God has invited into this race who finishes, that person's going to get salvation. That's what we take away from that. In fact, God says that for everyone that finishes the race, all obtain the prize together. Have you considered that? 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. Beginning in verse 13. But I do not want you to be ignorant, brethren, concerning those who have fallen asleep, lest you sorrow as others who have no hope. For if we believe that Jesus died and rose again, even so God will bring with him those who sleep in Jesus. For this we say to you by the word of the Lord, that we who are alive and remain until the coming of the Lord will by no means precede those who are asleep. Nobody gets in first. There's not a line up here, and only the first so many people can get in. Verse 16, for the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a shout, with the voice of an archangel, and with the trumpet of God, and the dead in Christ shall rise first. They're not alive, so they have to be resurrected. Then we who are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, and thus we shall always be with the Lord. Therefore, comfort one another with these words. Perhaps now more than ever, we need to be comforting one another with these words. The prize is before us, and every single one of us, everyone who competes for that prize, will win it if they just finish the race. That's the lesson, a lesson Paul wants us to take from that. A third lesson, it takes endurance to win the spiritual race. Endurance. Again, 1 Corinthians 9:25 says, and everyone who competes for the prize is temperate in all things. The King James Version says, and every man that strives for the mastery is temperate in all things. A clearer understanding would be, everyone that endeavors with strenuous zeal to obtain their desire disciplines themselves. I was going to give an example of myself being one that may not be in the most perfect shape at 56, but I was remembering years ago I'm not endorsing Saturday Night Live, but I'm going to illustrate my point with a skit that was done years and years ago when that was actually something funny to watch on a Saturday night real late. Those of you who knew John Belushi or who ever saw anything that John Belushi did, he was completely over the top on almost everything he did. Do you remember the Wheaties commercials, the old Wheaties commercials, that they would have an athlete like an Olympic athlete that won? I mean, the most famous one would be the Olympic, the multi-medal winner who was the gymnast. Can't remember her name for some reason. She was on Wheaties. Mary Lou Retton. Thank you, Becca. Mary Lou, remember her? She was on the Wheaties for years. So we kind of knew this context, so they decided to spoof that with John Belushi. And they show him competing in sort of an Olympic-like setting, and he's got an American flag that he, when he wins something, that he waves around. And they have him in his chubby body running around this track, and they show him in his final sprint past all these other athletes that are clearly in better shape than he is. And he somehow bolts past them at the end to win the mile race in 4 minutes and 11 seconds. I ran the mile when I was in high school. Let me tell you something. There's no way John Belushi's running a 4:11. That's just not going to happen. But yet he does. Now, what's funny about it is, in the context of disciplining yourself to actually be capable of doing that, they have John Belushi sitting at a table at the end of this fake commercial, and he's got a pile of tiny chocolate donuts in front of him and a box with the label, tiny chocolate donuts. He's smoking a cigarette. This is the guy who has disciplined himself to prepare himself to run a 4:11 mile. He's sitting there, and he says something like this. I logged a lot of miles training for that day, and I downed a lot of donuts. Little chocolate donuts. They taste good, and they've got the sugar I need to get me going in the morning. That's why little chocolate donuts have been on my training table since I was a kid. I'm in stitches watching this, because then he picks up, with this cigarette in his fingers, he picks up a chocolate donut and he starts to eat it. This is the image of the athlete who just won the Olympic gold medal in 4 minutes and 11 seconds. And I thought, that's not the image of an athlete that's going to be able to do that. That's not somebody who's been disciplining themselves for a victory. It is great imagery, but it isn't what we kind of expect to see in someone who's going to win. Why? Because in reality, Olympic athletes invest many, many hours, many years, in fact, in mastering their events. A 2012 study conducted by the UK's National Lottery of over 100 athletes in Great Britain preparing for the 2012 London Olympics. The study revealed the following. The average athlete, I just have a few statistics for you here. The average athlete consumes more than 1.1 million calories per year. During training, between 3,000 and 8,000 calories per day. To put that in perspective, the average person consumes between 1,600 and 3,000 calories per day. So if you're in training for the Olympics, how much more energy do you need? Or how much harder you're working? You need a lot of calories to keep up with the energy that you're expending. The average athlete commits 6 hours a day, 6 days a week to training and competitions. You imagine? That's a full-time job. The average athlete has been working towards their Olympic goal for 11 years. The average athlete seriously took up their sport at the age of 14 and now competes in 7 international competitions per year. To say that they invest everything they have to win would be an understatement. One of the reasons Paul's analogy of the Olympic athletes is so effective for our spiritual race is because we can readily see the effort that they must put forth to compete at the highest level. Every athlete that intends to win their event must develop the endurance necessary for victory. It takes discipline to train the body to have the right amount of endurance to finish a race in the shortest amount of time. Incredible discipline on diet, on activities, what you do in your off hours. You discipline yourself. You bring yourself completely under control, or you're not going to attain the prize. Hebrews 12, verse 1. Hebrews chapter 12. And verse 1. Therefore we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. We understand that Paul, most likely the writer of this, and it would make a lot of sense in the context of what we just read in 1 Corinthians, that he wrote this to the Hebrews. Run the race with endurance. That takes discipline to be able to have the endurance that we need to finish the race that is set before us. You know, the kind of endurance necessary to win a sprint is very different from the kind of energy is necessary to win a long-distance race. I looked up some of the statistics on current world records to give you a sense of the difference between this and why endurance matters and the kind of endurance that we are trying to give ourselves that we must have in order to be able to finish the race we've been called to. The 100-meter world record is 9.58 seconds, so it's under 10 seconds. The 400 meters, 43.03 seconds. The 800 meters, 1 minute, 40 seconds. And the 1,500 meters, just short of a mile, is 3 minutes and 26 seconds. Now, think about this. If the endurance that it took to win the 1,500 was exactly the same as the 100, then why isn't the winning time 2 minutes and 26 seconds? Do you think these guys are lazy? You think they're just not putting in the effort? If you walk down each and every one of them, they're all slower in pace than the 100 meter. The 200 meter is slower in pace than the 100 meter and faster than the 400 meter. And the 400 meter is slower than both the 200 and the 100, but much faster than the mile, or the 1500 meters in this case. So they do require different amounts of energy to be able to do that. Our race is not a sprint. So if we're putting forth the effort, it calls to mind to me the scripture that talks about the seed. There are some who get super excited about the calling and they love it for a brief period. Then a rabbit runs by or something and they're distracted from how important it really was to them, and they're no longer, you know, in the church. What happened? Well, they had endurance for a little while, but they didn't have the endurance that it took to finish this long race we're in. It's not a sprint. We are not in a sprint. We're in a long distance race, proverbially. This is our reality spiritually. How far we have to go matters. We don't measure our journey in distance. We measure it in time. In fact, we measure it in years. How many years? We saw, I think it was on the opening day, raising of hands on how many people, this number of feasts this was for some. And I think we had some over 50 years that raised their hands. This is not a short duration of time. For many of us, this is many, 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 many years. We have to run this race with endurance if we're going to last years in this race, this spiritual race. This is why Paul said we must run our race with endurance. You know, this concept is so important that Jesus Christ wanted us to be thinking about that long before we got baptized. He wanted us to decide to commit first, that we were willing to do what it takes. We were willing to put in that discipline ourselves, and endure to the finish of this race, however long it took. This is what Christ meant in Luke chapter 14. Luke chapter 14, I'm going to begin in verse 28. Luke 14, 28 says, "For which of you, intending to build a tower, intending to enter a long-distance race, does not sit down first to count the cost, whether he has enough to finish it, lest after he has laid the foundation and is not able to finish, all who see it begin to mock him, saying, 'This man began to build and was not able to finish.' Or what king, going to war against another king, does not sit down first and consider whether he is able with 10,000 to meet him who comes against him with 20,000? Or else, while the other is still a great way off, he sends a delegation and asks conditions of peace. So likewise, whoever of you does not forsake all that he has cannot be my disciple." Once we put our hand to the plow, we're supposed to be in this thing for the long haul. And we were supposed to make that decision before we got baptized, that we do have what it takes. I'm capable of doing it. Every single one of us who's been baptized would probably readily say, "I understood, though, when I did that I was going to need the Holy Spirit to help me to do it." No question about it. We need a helper. That's why we get baptized. But we've made a commitment. And that commitment is to discipline ourselves and prepare ourselves to finish the race, no matter what. And that takes endurance. 4 years. Not a short sprint. This is a long run, spiritually. Finally, we cannot win if we don't cross the finish line, if we don't complete the race. So winning the prize requires us to cross the finish line. That's why we need endurance, so that we can cross the finish line. It's not a sprint. It's a long, long run. How we run when we know where the finish line is, how far away it is, and how long it will take us to get there is very different than how we must run when we don't know where the finish line is. You know, I have been thinking a lot about this challenge that we face in our spiritual race. You see, every runner in a race has a finish line he's running to. I know how far I'm going to have to go. You know, what's interesting about how the brain and the body work? Your brain analyzes your physical condition, your preparation, and your training so that when you enter a race, your brain determines how much energy you need, and it budgets that out across the duration of the race for you, such that when you finish the race, you've expended the energy that you had for it. You don't have a large reservoir back there behind you someplace, someplace deep within your bowels that somehow magically just exists. If you have a big reservoir at the end of your race, you didn't do your best, because you should have almost nothing left. Leave it all on the field is a common phrase. Leave it all on the track. Give it everything you've got. Don't leave anything behind. That's the concept. Here's how the brain works, though. Let's say, because this is what we're dealing with COVID, this moving and shifting requirements and all of this. So we're all living this, but we're also living it spiritually. Who doesn't realize that we've all believed, at one point or another in our baptism, we've believed that Jesus Christ was going to return in our lifetime? You know, in the 1980s, we thought it was really easy to believe that Christ was going to return in our lifetime. Why? Because I was in my late teens, early 20s. I've got 60 years in front of me. Surely Christ is going to return in 60 years, right? Surely by then he would have to. Well, now I'm 56, and I'm thinking, maybe not. Could be yes, could be no. You know, the church years and years ago, we're all famous that the church, at that time, the Worldwide Church of God, was convinced that Christ was going to return. At least some in the church, if not the vast majority, were convinced that Christ would return in 1975. What happens when we set a goal and then we realize that goal isn't what actually was the goal? Meaning, Christ didn't return in 1975. What happened to all of those people who thought he was going to return in 1975? What is the energy and the effort that you put in that was necessary to get you to 1975? Well, we are many, many years past 1975, and Jesus Christ has not returned. This is the endurance race that we're in. And the fact of the matter is, we're not the boss of when Christ returns. And that means that that is a finish line we don't know. If you and I went out on a run together, this is pure fantasy because I'm not inviting anybody out on a run. But if we went out on a run together and we were going to go, let's say, if we're going to have a fantasy, let's just say we were going to go run for 3 miles. Somehow I was in physical good enough shape that we could do that. And we're going to run 3 miles. And so we decide, let's run 3 miles together. We're running the 3 miles together, okay? And we get to the end of the 3 miles. Now let's say, because this is what tends to happen, let's say 3 miles is pretty easy for both of us. Like, that's not really a hard thing for us. And so, you know, we might be challenging each other a little bit, and we're pushing it a little bit to get to that 3 miles, and we get to that 3 miles, and maybe I pull just a little ahead of you. Well, what if, as we cross that 3 mile marker, I said to you, I was just joking, we're going to run 10. Do you think you feel differently when you're looking at, wait a minute, I got to run another 7 miles? I just pushed a lot of energy out in that first three. What do I have left to run another 7? That's a shifting finish line. What does our brain do? Well, our brain had already calculated what I needed to run 3 miles against my friend who's being a jerk now by saying we got to run 10. Maybe I don't have enough energy to run the 10. Why? Because I budgeted it for the short distance, not the long distance. I want to read from an article on a website I found called podiumrunner.com. The article is titled, "What If There Is No Finish Line?" Man, that leapt off the page to me leapt off the screen. Tongue-tied there for a second. Because that's what many of us have faced when we look at Jesus Christ hasn't returned yet. Jesus Christ hasn't returned yet. We have to keep going. We have to keep going. We don't know where this finish line is. We like to think when we look at the times we live in that we could say, well, it looks like it's going to be much shorter, but what if it's not? Because we have no idea, that's a finish line, we don't know where it is. What happens? Well, this author, Jonathan Beverly, was exploring this idea, not in a spiritual context, he's exploring this idea from a COVID context. Why? Well, early in the article he says, well, look, the reality is when we first started to see the reactions to COVID, it was, we're going to take 2 weeks. And we're going to use that to flatten the curve, right? That was the original thing. Well, we get not even 10 days. And that 2 weeks turns into 3 weeks more. Then we're not done with that 3 weeks before we're told there's going to be another 6 weeks. And that line kept moving. Well, where are we today? We're back to the same lines. Why? We need to. We're trying to flatten the curve here at the feast to say we don't want to send everyone home with COVID. But just like that for us, it's the same, isn't it? We came here with one expectation. We went a certain distance, and things changed. We now have a different expectation. This is what COVID has done to us. It has changed or has moved the finish line, the requirements. They continue to be moved as we respond to this virus. That's what this author is trying to deal with. So let me read to you here a quote from them. Specifically about what if we don't know where the finish line is? He's saying COVID. Well, what if COVID's finish line is 5 years from now? We don't know. So he's asking the question here as I read this quote. But what if the finish line is unknown? Now, remember, he's coming at this as a long-distance runner, a professional long-distance runner. And so he's trying to address this thing from a running perspective and the endurance that it takes to run these long-distance races he's used to doing. He continues, studies show that lacking an endpoint, not only does the same effort feel harder than if we know how far we're going, our bodies will also reduce the level of effort we're able to put out in order to conserve energy for that unknown possibility. And in a study that replicated the what-if scenario above, when runners who were told they were going to run 10 minutes at a set pace, then when the 10 minutes were up, had to keep going for another 10 minutes, their perceived effort during the second 10 minutes was significantly higher than when they knew from the beginning that it would last 20 minutes. Even though they were running the same pace for the same distance both times. So do you understand what they're saying? He's saying, study how an athlete reacts to a changed finish line. The effort when that finish line is moved, the perceived effort, how much I feel it more when that finish line has moved, is dramatically more. I feel it more, even though the energy I've expended is identical. But that's the way our bodies perceive it when we set for ourselves a finish line that moves. How has our spiritual endurance been affected by waiting for Christ to return? It's the same question. Used to think it was going to be in the 70s, and then we thought it might be in the 80s or the 90s or the early 2000s, and now it might be the years 20, someplace around 2030. Who knows? We don't know. The finish line seems to continue to move. Well, the reality is that God decides where the finish line is, and we keep wanting to tell him when that finish line should be. Maybe we're getting tired. Could there be a greater unknown finish line than not knowing when Christ will return? Well, not spiritually. I mean, that's the great unknown for us. You know, consider that the belief that Jesus Christ will return in our lifetime has always existed. It's not a new phenomena. It's amazing when you think about it. You know, did Paul think that Christ was going to return in his lifetime? We read earlier from 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. Let me read again verses 16 and 17 for you. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, 16 and 17. For the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a shout, with the voice of an archangel and with the trumpet of God, and the dead in Christ shall rise first. Then we who are alive. Paul is writing this. He is a part of the we who is alive. And he thinks Jesus Christ is going to return in his lifetime. When he's writing these words, this is not something that's new. We've all believed Christ is going to return in our lifetime. And I'm not saying that's inappropriate, because it should give us a sense of urgency that we should be preparing for that. That's what we're supposed to be doing. But the phenomena is not new. So Paul thought that. Read 1 Peter and then read 2 Peter. If you read them from the perspective of, does Peter think Christ is going to return in his lifetime? You're going to see how he wrote 1 Peter. Yes, very clearly he believed that in his lifetime Christ was going to return. But by the time he writes 2 Peter, he now understands that's not going to happen. The tone, the tenor of the information, of how he pleads what he wants to share with people that he knows are not going to see the return of Jesus Christ? Very different. Paul came to that same realization, but when? At the very end. As he writes in 2 Timothy, he's basically telling Timothy, I finally get it. It isn't going to happen in my lifetime. So he's setting up Timothy to be an effective, with a baton, so to speak. He's setting up Timothy to try to be successful as a preacher, as Paul, when Paul is no longer there. 2 Timothy chapter 4, verses 6 through 8. 2 Timothy 4, 6 through 8. For I am already being poured out as a drink offering, and the time of my departure is at hand. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. Finally, there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will give to me on that day, and not to me only, but also to all who have loved his appearing. Isn't that encouraging? Paul, at the very end, knowing, not going to see Jesus Christ returned, unshaken in his belief that he had already finished his race. It's just a matter of time now before he would be killed. He knew his future wasn't bright from where he was writing this. And yet he wanted us to be encouraged. We're going to see him. He's not going to get there before we do, because he's going to be resurrected as a first fruit along with everyone else who's a first fruit at the same time, so that he, along with all the rest of us who are alive at the return of Jesus Christ, are going to inherit the kingdom together. I have heroes of the Bible. I'm sure you do. I'm comforted knowing that we're going to rise together and receive the reward together. I'm not pushed down to the bottom of the line because I was called years after many others were. Christ knew that the delay could be a problem for us. It's been a problem for everyone, I would imagine, who's ever been called, who had to endure to the end of their life, that this had to be a challenge. And Christ knew that it would be. And he told us that it would be in Luke chapter 12. Luke chapter 12, beginning of verse 35, Luke 12, 35. Let your waist be girded and your lamps burning. And you yourselves be like men who wait for their master when he will return from the wedding, that when he comes and knocks, they may open to him immediately. Okay, this is the idea of us believing he would return in our lifetime. We need to be prepared. And we still, he's saying, you still need to be prepared as though it's going to happen, because it could. And he wants us to be ready to open the door. Verse 37, blessed are those servants whom the master, when he comes, will find watching, prepared, ready. Assuredly, I say to you, that he will gird himself and have them sit down to eat, and will come and serve them. And if he should come in the second watch, or come in the third watch, and find them so, blessed are those servants. He's saying they thought it would be the first watch, and they were ready. It wasn't in the first watch, so they thought it was going to be in the second watch, and they were ready. He didn't come in the second watch. They thought it would be in the third watch. Did they give up? Did they go to bed? Did they stop? No. He found them ready in the third watch. This is the shifting finish line. They're still ready. They're still ready. They're still ready. Verse 39, but know this, that if the master of the house had known what hour the thief would come, he would have watched and not allowed his house to be broken into. Therefore, you also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming in an hour that you do not expect. Then Peter said to him, Lord, do you speak this parable only to us or to all people? And the Lord said, who then is that faithful and wise steward whom his master will make ruler over his household to give them their portion of food in due season? Blessed is that servant whom his master will find so doing when he comes. We need to be ready. We need to prepare as though he is going to come in our lifetime. That's clearly what he's telling us. Truly I say to you that he will make him ruler over all that he has. But if that servant says in his heart, my master is delaying his coming. And this is the challenge for all of us. And begins to beat the male and female servants and to eat and drink and be drunk. The master of that servant will come on a day when he is not looking for him, and at an hour when he is not aware, and will cut him in two and appoint him his portion with the unbelievers. That's a scary prophecy about potentially about our future if we give up. If we turn, if we just don't have any more to give to this race we've been called to. Well, that doesn't look very good for us. We have to stick it out. We've got to make sure we have enough endurance to finish this race. Christ is acknowledging the reality that when the finish line is not known, people tend to get weary in well-doing. That's just a part of being human. We have to be aware of that, and we have to prepare for that. Paul warned the Corinthians of this problem. And I'm going to read this next one in the God's Word translation because I really like how he fleshed it out more correctly. From Galatians chapter 6 and verse 9. Galatians 6 and verse 9. Don't let me read it, and then you can read it later. Galatians 6, 9. We can't allow ourselves to get tired of living the right way. Certainly, each of us will receive everlasting life at the proper time if we don't give up. That's the point. When you don't know the finish line and it keeps moving on us, it's easy to get tired, to grow weary, and to want to give up. We can't give up. I want to read another portion of this article that I quoted earlier from PodiumRunner.com. For context, I've already explained to you that this runner was writing this from the context of coping with COVID. I want us to listen to this from the context of our spiritual journey, our spiritual race that we are running together. I want you to listen to what he talks about here. I'd like you to listen to the points that are being made on how to win a race with no finish line and draw your own spiritual lessons on this, because each and every one of us has to sort out what discipline for me looks like so that I have enough endurance to finish the race. Every single one of us has to do that for ourselves. Subtitle of this particular portion of the article is titled, A Race with No Finish Line. Quote, given the parallels between how we feel when faced with unknown running finish lines and unknown life situation endpoints, I wondered if running could shed some light to help us deal with the pandemic, and if in turn we could look for ways that enduring the pandemic will make us better runners in the end, enduring our spiritual race. And who better to ask than someone who has excelled at an event as close as possible to the current world situation, a race with no finish line. As I write this, I'm continuing to quote, Courtney Dowalter, ultra running champion, has just won the 2020 U.S. Biggs Backyard Ultra. I had never heard of U.S. Biggs Backyard Ultra before. I didn't know there was a race like this out there. I never would have entered it, even if I knew about it. Here's what the rules are. He says, the rules of this race are simple. You have to show up at the start line at the top of each hour and complete a 4.2-mile loop before the next hour rolls around. Each and every hour. The last person standing wins. 2 years ago, Dowalter got second place by completing more than 250 miles over 2.5 days. This year, she tied the previous record, going 68 hours and 283 miles. There's no finish line in this race because it's an endurance race, period. How long can you go? Now, I thought, this is somebody we might want to pay attention to. How do you do that? Think about what she did. Nearly 3 full days, no resting on that comfy bed, sleeping, curled up with your favorite blanket, Mm-mm. Every single hour, you show up at the start line again and you run 4.2 miles. And for those of you who don't know, she's probably averaging someplace between 8-9 miles per hour. 8 or 9 minutes, that's probably what she's running, which means it's going to take her 35 to 45 minutes to run that. So she gets about a 15-minute break to do what? Hydrate, eat. She got 3 full days. She's eating during her breaks, and then she's back at that starting line, and she's going to run another 4.2 miles. And she's going to have 15 minutes to gather herself and to figure out how she's going to be able to run another 4.2 miles. Why? Well, because other runners are continuing to run, and she wants to win. And there's no finish line to this. So I want to read, let me continue reading here because I thought this is absolutely fascinating and I think each and every one of us can learn something from her. These next sections are titled in a way that she was essentially introducing her concepts. This one here calls Change the Focus. How do you do it is the question he's asking her. How did you do this? How do you get your mind around such a race? I'm quoting him now. She says, keep the focus on this. What can I do right now? DeWalter told me last week, because I know that I have to keep moving forward. So not wrapping it all up in focusing on a finish line, then trying to be really present in the moment. If the reality is that forward motion is required, then I try to think through the facts and stay where my feet are on how to move forward as best I can. Second area, assess the facts. DeWalter finds it important to assess the current facts and separate them from the emotions of the situation. Quoting her, how's it going? What do I need right now? She asks herself. And then pushing past any of those speed bumps along the way and forgetting them. Does that sound familiar? Scripturally? She says, I push past all that and forget them, leaving them really in the past and not dwelling on what they did to me or how bad they wrecked me in the moment. Just taking account of the facts. What are the facts of this situation right now and then adapting? The third area, avoid expectations. She's also leery of setting expectations that can get dashed and make emotions worse. Quoting her, when people ask, how many miles or hours am I trying to go at Big's backyard? I don't have an answer for that, she said. I do think it's dangerous if you get attached to a certain distance or marker in life for this race. If I'm attached to 300 miles and then we get to 300 miles and the race is still going, and that's not the end, it would be kind of a blow. And it would feel like you need to get your mind back in it, get your body back in it, and physically ramp yourself back up into the battle again. Attaching to those finish lines, if you're not sure there is going to be a finish line, is a little bit tricky in anything. Her fourth answer, control the controllables. Not attaching yourself to a variable you don't know and can't control just distracts you from the tasks of assessing, adapting, and keeping moving. That factors into the pandemic and also races, DeWalter says. How long is it going to last? That's not something you can control. So not something to lose energy or sleep over if you can avoid it. Because controlling the controllables is how you can make it a little bit easier, I think. As I said, I wanted to read through that without bombarding you with scriptures to support her point. She didn't come at it from a spiritual perspective. She came at it from the perspective of what does it take to endure something as difficult as what she has endured with Big's backyard ultra race. And there are lessons for us in how she does that, how she was able to do that, how any runner would be able to do that. And those lessons can be applied by us spiritually. And I think each and every one of us needs to take the opportunity to reflect on that for ourselves. What is it that I'm going to have to do to make sure that I can keep going? What does all this have to do with the Feast of Tabernacles? We're here at the Feast of Tabernacles. We cannot let our guard down. We cannot lose our focus. We cannot give up before we've reached the end of our race and crossed the finish line. The God who made us and knows how our minds work, who knows we need to be reminded of why we are enduring the trials and tribulations of our calling, has brought us here to the feast. Every year he provides for us the Feast of Tabernacles, different than every other feast, because it gives us a glimpse, doesn't it, of the prize. Yes, it's a tiny, tiny glimpse. It's a sliver. It's the tip of a needle. But every year we get reminded that we're pursuing a prize, the kingdom of God, not just being in it, but being a first fruit, which means it's not just about me. Jesus Christ needs me, he needs you. He needs all of us to be there with him to put God's government on this earth. So we have a big job in front of us. It's a huge prize. It's fantastic. It's the ultimate prize, something worthy of being of our craving. Every year we get to go to the feast and be reminded of that and get a tiny taste. All the little things we do, eating out, who cares? But yet we get to do a little bit. We spend 1/10 of our income in 7 or 8 or 9 or 10 days. It's a huge amount of money in a very small window of time that you get to spend. If you've saved your tithe faithfully, you'll have a lot of money to spend. Who cares? That's not the prize. It's just a glimpse of the prize. It's just a tiny taste of the prize that's waiting for us. And every year, because Christ knows, because God knows, because he created us, that we need help. We are not going to be able to keep going without some help. And so we get to see that prize refreshed in our mind. That's what we're pursuing, so that we can keep going in this endurance race of life, this endurance race that we're in spiritually, that we've been called to. God gives us a glimpse of the millennial future to help us, in part, to have something to hold on to, a vision that we can desire, we can crave, that we should crave. That time yet to come when Jesus Christ returns, when the government, all of the governments of men are finally put down, when the rule of man over man ends. I mean, are we not tired yet of this world? Are you sick and tired of this world yet? The depravity, the violence, the immorality, the utter lack of respect human beings seem to have for one another? If we're not tired of this yet, I don't know what else it will take for us. There's something better coming, and we're going to be a part of that. That's why we're here at this feast, to be reminded of that in part, that that's our future, not this. I've long said to Becca, you see people who chase immortality. We see movies all the time about people chasing immortality in a physical body. I don't want to be immortal in this physical body. I hurt and ache all the time. I don't want to be a million years of hurting and aching. Are you kidding me? No, thank you. I want a new body, and I want to take my position with Jesus Christ when he returns in his kingdom, and I want to help him put down the governments of man and put God's government on this earth once and for all, for the good of all. That's why we're here at this feast. But we need to have endurance to finish this race so that we can claim that prize that God has in store for us. May God speed the day when our race, our spiritual race, is finally done.